Thank you, George. I've had some really, really embarrassing circumstances and experiences trying to evangelise, especially with my neighbours. I've got a neighbour who's a council worker and a neighbour who was a driver for Ansett for about 40 years. I live in Botany, down near the airport, where you can really feel the serenity. It's a nice place. It's a mixed place. It's got people like Roy across the road, who built his own house 55 years ago, has stayed there, looked after his dementing wife for a long time before he had to put her into a home. Salt of the earth, the unofficial mayor of Botany, everyone knows him. He's just fantastic. I am hopeless at talking to him about Christianity. We can chat about the garden, we can talk about the kids. I just have no idea what language to use to talk to him about Christian things. Other neighbours. We've kind of got the castle living next door to us, actually. It's it's an extended family, a couple of stories, massive kind of McMansion-y thing going on. I can't get a word in about Christianity. I have no idea. I'm lost as to how to do it. I don't stand here as an expert on how to reach people, reach men for Christ. I just stand here as someone who's trying to do it in my own particular scene. Now, I might have been born a Westie, but, you know, I've spent most of my time at university. I know how to talk to students about this stuff. I know how to talk to people who've got questions about the philosophy, about the apologetic stuff, the history stuff. I can do that. But that's kind of my scene. That's what I can do well. We all need each other if we're going to reach men for Christ, because we all reach into different parts of the culture. So what I'm doing here today, I hope will be really useful for some of you. I'm not pretending that all of you are really keen to understand what's going on in the new atheism, what Richard Dawkins is writing, and, you know, what all those guys are talking about, and whether the arguments for God make sense. But some of you will. Some of you will have friends who've got those questions. Some of you might get the opportunity in your workplace when it comes up, when someone sees Richard Dawkins on TV and wonders what that's all about. So that's my gig. That's my bit. That's the bit I can do well, and I hope that that'll be really useful for you today. But I just want to say up front, we need each other. We need the cultural reach of all the blokes in this room, because we can't all talk to all the men around us. We've got to specialise a bit, and that's what I'm trying to do. So today I want to talk about this movement, the New Atheism. Just out of interest, how many have come across an atheist writer, read one of their books, Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, seen him on TV, on the radio? Just a show of hands if you had anything to do with it at all. Okay, that's encouraging. About half the room has come into contact with this. And that's really, really interesting. Why has atheism kind of got back on the public agenda? I mean, I think when I was an undergraduate student, you only heard about atheism in the kind of philosophy of religion classroom. I never spoke about it with my neighbours. I never spoke about it with people outside of the uni scene. But it has crept into our lives. This movement, and it is a movement called the New Atheism, is a significant part of our culture now. And so half the room here has had something to do with it. Well, I want to introduce you to the New Atheists, talk about why I think atheism is now a significant part of our culture, tear apart what atheism is, because it's not one thing. There are different kinds of atheism, different varieties of atheism. And then give us, as Christian men, some things to remember as we try to talk with those around us about what it means to be a Christian in contrast with being an atheist. So that's where we're going. You've got the, you know the drill, you've got the handout there, a few spaces to write notes. Let's start with three reasons why atheism is in the news. Incidentally, this picture on the front here, all these people holding that book. When do you see people holding books close to them? What sort of image does that portray? What kind of book do you hold close to your heart like that? Your holy text. The thing you think represents your life. This is a bunch of people who sent photos of themselves holding Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, to his website on his 64th birthday or something. And they're collected together as birthday greetings to Richard Dawkins. This stuff is serious. People put his book to their heart and say thank you. This is serious stuff that we're dealing with here today. The New Atheism is a movement. It's not just a bunch of philosophers telling us what they think. So why is it around? I think there are three main reasons. The first is September 11, 2001. I only need to say the date and you know what I'm talking about. See, up until the end of the 20th century, religion had kind of fallen off the public agenda. We didn't talk about it that much. It wasn't seen as significant to policy issues in government. It was dying off as an area of study. In fact, capitalism was heading around the world as the kind of key philosophy that's going to take us forward. And a guy called Francis Fukuyama even wrote a book that talked about the end of history. No one's going to worry about this ideology stuff anymore because capitalism, democratic capitalism, is the end point for us. That's the best kind of worldview we've got. It's just going to move around the world peacefully and we'll all be better off. And then the planes hit the Twin Towers. And suddenly we remembered that most of the world is religious. Most people have a view about God. Some people have a view about God that drives them so much that they're willing to sacrifice their own lives and kill many others because they think they're serving that God. Religion really affects people. And September 11 reminded us of that. In response to September 11, those who thought religion was a bad thing got up and said, we've got to do something about this. Look what religion did to those poor innocent people in New York, in Washington DC, in that field in Pennsylvania. Look at what religion does around the world. We've got to get up, we atheists, we irreligious people, and say, enough's enough. We've got something better. Second reason that atheism is being talked about a lot now is that there's a lot of study going on of religion. A lot of surveys, a lot of studying the data, a lot of thinking through what it is that people believe. And it's partly the kind of global movement. We now know what's going on in the world much more than we did even 10, 20 years ago. We're very aware of cultures around the world now. We can study things more effectively through the internet, through global communications. And it's really fascinating when you start to look at religion around the globe and whether religion is a good or bad thing for the world. See, the atheist writers, almost without exception, say that we would be better off without religion. But when you actually study the data, you get different results. There was a meta-survey done of 100 studies in this area, looking at what is the connection between having a spiritual view of the world with a belief in God and some set of kind of laws or behaviours that you adhere to or try to, the connection between that and human well-being. So is there any connection between your beliefs in the spiritual realm and whether you feel like you're having a good time in life, and where well-being is a kind of index of things like health, happiness, prosperity, all those sorts of things packed together in this term, well-being. Well, the stats come out in an interesting way. I'm sure the atheists would think it's the reverse to what it really is. 79% of these studies, 79 of the 100 studies, demonstrated a positive connection between having a spiritual worldview and human well-being. 79 of those 100 studies said it's good to believe in a God, to have a kind of set of behaviours that you live by. It's actually good for human beings. 13% found a kind of confused reaction or one that was very difficult to tease out. 7% found no correlation between them. Only one of those 100 studies found a negative correlation between having a religious view of the world and human well-being. Only one of the 100 studies said religion's bad for you. Now, that is the entire opposite of what the atheist writers say in their books. Many of them claim to be scientists, to look at data, to reason it through. But when you actually look at the data, it's telling us that human beings need God. God is part of what it means to live well in this world. So something weird is going on there where the protesting atheists aren't actually attending to this science. If you want to see the details of that study, you can look in the book I mentioned, The Further Reading, by Alistair McGrath, Dawkins' God. Well, that's two reasons why atheism's around in the news. The third reason is an interesting one too, in that we've now entered the 21st century. We've had enough time to start looking back and thinking about what happened in the 20th century. When we do that, atheism has a very bad track record. You see, many atheist writers are saying, we ought to just try it. We've been trapped by religion for so long. It's about time we got out and tried something that cut off the shackles and lowered the ceiling, got rid of that God figure, and let's see how well we can do as human beings. But we have tried it. We tried it in the totalitarian regimes of the middle of the 20th century. Stalin tried it. Mao tried it. The results have been terrible. The results of atheist thinking translated into politics have been suffering. Religion is often accused of causing wars, of ruining the world, terrible to link the church and the state. And I think that's true. I think there's some terrible things that have been done in the name of this religion or the other, when you've linked kind of Christ the King and the King of the Land too closely together. But atheism has not been any better. In fact, just by sheer numbers of people killed under regimes, atheism has been far, far worse. The number of people killed in the 20th century outstrips the number of people killed in all the centuries you know of beforehand. And much of that was done under the name of human progress, human improvement, without God. So when you start to see that kind of scene, if you are an atheist, you've got to talk things up really loud. And that's what we're starting to see happen now with the various people I'm about to introduce you to. Atheists are talking loudly because the evidence is actually against them. Well, let's meet some of these figures. Now, you may or may not have read these books, but these are five of the key figures in the atheist movement. And I say it is a movement. It's not just people writing books, because they're trying to gather together in a way that atheists haven't in the past. They're trying to develop a kind of church of atheism. If you go to Richard Dawkins' website, you can see a directory of organisations that you can get in contact with if you want to get rid of your unwanted religiosity. It's a movement that's developing. They run kids' camps now for atheist parents because they've seen how well the churches do it. Send your kids to a Christian camp, they're going to hear the gospel. Send your kids to an atheist camp if you don't want them to hear the gospel. They're very serious about this, and they're doing it, they're moving forward in social ways. So here they are. The first chap is Christopher Hitchens. He's a UK journalist, a very entertaining writer. He likes his persona of himself as the kind of intellectual drunk. He often does his lectures with a bottle of something next to him. And he likes that kind of persona, so I'm not dissing him by saying that. He wrote a book called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Subtitle's got it all, hasn't it? And through that book, he tells stories across religions, across different cultures, terrible anecdotes of the awful things done in the name of one religion or the other. So that by the end of it, you think, well, anyone who is involved in religion at all must be like these guys, these terrible people who've slaughtered, who've abused women, who've killed children, you know, who've been involved in terrible oppression. Religion must be about oppression and poisoning, says Christopher Hitchens. Second chap on the list is Sam Harris, youngest of this group, who has taken, in a sense, a more reasoned approach to the topic and said what we need to do in his book, The End of Faith, and another one called Letter to a Christian Nation, the American Nation, what we've got to do is get back to reason. Religion's all about irrationality. It's all about feelings. It's all about just communities doing what makes them feel good. Let's get back to reason, because reason leads to love, says Sam Harris. And he looks back to the classical writers and says, that's what we need, rational discussion, rational society that will lead us to love. Third chap on the list is a scientist, studies the brain, Daniel Dennett. And his book is Breaking the Spell, which talks about religion being a natural phenomenon. He's taking another approach, saying brain science is showing us that we know the bits of your brain that make you religious. He admits that we don't quite know yet, but he sees into the future like a prophet, that we are going to know this, and we're on the way there, so that one day we'll detect why it is exactly in your brain that you're religious. My problem with that is I don't care. It doesn't relate to whether or not there is a God really or at all. Maybe God has set up our brains so that we can get in contact with him. Makes sense to me as a Christian. Fourth chap on the list is the spelling mistake in his name, sorry. It's Michel Onfray, who wrote the Atheist Manifesto, one of the more hubristic of the books, the in a sense a bit showy-offy, in my view, as my kids would say. A bit showy-offy because he's a philosopher, a French philosopher, and he uses the style of some famous European philosophers to convince us that religion actually is just silly. It's just silly, old-fashioned thinking. On our website, Centre for Public Christianity, you can see a critique of this book showing where we, in fact, feel he is rather silly in some of the things he said about Christianity. I don't know if John mentioned that this morning. But here's the star, number five, Richard Dawkins. Professor Dawkins, he's the professor of the Chair for the Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford, a chair funded by a Microsoft executive who said, we want Dawkins in this chair. And he's used that chair to promote atheism because he believes there is a distinct and direct link between understanding science properly and being an atheist. He thinks if you understand the world scientifically, you will be an atheist. Now, by no means all of his colleagues are with him on this. Scientists are quite split on whether or not science leads you to atheism or to nowhere or to God. They're split. You'll find people in each camp. But Dawkins is convinced that belief in God is a delusion, and a dangerous delusion, one that causes pain and suffering, one that stops people being free to live the kinds of lives they ought to live. He's very serious about this. At the beginning of his book, The God Delusion, he says, I want religious people to be atheists by the time they put this down. It's an evangelistic mission that he is on. So deeply does he believe it to be true that we would be better off without God. Dawkins uses all sorts of approaches to his topic, from witty rhetoric, where he condemns God for being the most horrible character in all fiction, a comment that immediately makes you feel like that God must not be real, clever rhetoric, through to dismissive discussion of philosophical arguments that have been had for centuries that he can cover in about 10 pages, through to terrible, heartbreaking stories about awful things that have been done by Christian people, about the letters he's been sent by Christians who've called him Satan-worshipping scum and hope he dies in hell with a terrible disease. You know, awful, awful things that I'm not going to stand up and defend. If any Christian brother, by the way, says that about Dawkins, I'm not going to stand behind you. That's awful. But he mounts up these kind of arguments, anecdotes, evidence against religion, so that by the end of The God Delusion, you kind of feel disgusted with religious people. You kind of feel disgusted with God by the end of it all. It's a clever book. I think it's full of flaws. But it's a book that tells you how much these people believe we've got to get away from God in order to live better lives. So we need to tease that out a bit and say, well, what is it about atheism that these guys are trying to sell us? What is it that our friends might be hearing or reading as they dip into the God delusion on the train? What's attractive about it? I mean, if you're a Christian here, you've been attracted to God through the figure of Jesus Christ. But what's attractive about atheism to people today? Or is it only a tiny, tiny group of people who find this at all attractive? What is atheism? How are we going to tease out our understanding of it in about half an hour? Well, I've done got it into four varieties of atheism that I think help us understand what's going on. The first is philosophical atheism. That's the view that theism is illogical, and sometimes that atheism is actually logical. But let's just stick with the first one, that theism is illogical. So these guys are teaching that if you say there is a God who is real, you're not making a statement that makes sense. It's illogical. How do they explore this? Well, most of the time they go back to the kind of arguments that were developed in the Middle Ages for God's existence and tell you that they don't work. None of these arguments work. So you hear a discussion about the argument from the design of the universe. What a wonderful universe we have, so complex, so difficult to come about by chance. And they'll say that doesn't work because we know it happened by evolution. Now, there's a lot to be said about that. I'll say a bit more later. But that's the kind of philosophical atheism that's developed. You say, look, we just don't believe any of those arguments for God's existence. We just don't think they're true. We just don't think they hold up. Well, I'm very, very disappointed in Richard Dawkins and the way he does this, because there is a great discussion, a great tradition of thinking through whether you can come up with a good argument for God's existence. I'm sure many of you have done it, you know, often late at night, maybe after a glass or two of wine, it gets kind of going that, you know, could we prove that God existed? The thing is, most people who believe in God don't think you can prove that God exists. Because we don't think God is a mathematical equation. You can prove things in maths, but that's about it. Even in the law, when you say you've proven your case, well, you know that there's kind of room to move, don't you? It's just you've got beyond reasonable doubt. Dawkins and the others seem to apply the maths thinking to God. Whereas pretty much everyone who believes in God thinks of God in some kind of personal or other way, so that using mathematical kind of proofs is never going to get us there. Where we do think it's useful to argue about God's existence is to say it points us towards God. So why is there something in the world rather than nothing? Deep. Why is there something rather than nothing? Well, either it suddenly, spontaneously came into existence, or there was some kind of intelligence there that brought it into existence. Which are you inclined towards? Now, I think I know probably in this room which you feel. But that's an argument worth having, isn't it? That's at least a late night conversation worth having. You know, why is there something rather than nothing? Those kind of arguments lead you towards God. You're not going to prove God that way, but they're useful. Dawkins and the others dismiss them as if they had no value whatsoever. Furthermore, Dawkins puts forward his own argument why there is almost certainly no God. In fact, that's the chapter title in the God Delusion, why there is almost certainly no God. It goes a bit like this. I'll see if I can do the 10-second version of it. You have to chew on it a bit later. It's called the argument from improbability. He says, this world is so complex, so incredible, so finely tuned that it beggars belief that it came about by chance. It beggars belief. Let's accept that. Well, theists are saying that this incredible world was caused by a God. Now, for a God to be able to make this incredible world, God has to be actually more complex than the world he creates. He's got to be kind of beyond the world he creates to be able to do it. So if the world itself beggars belief coming about as so incredibly, incredibly, incredibly unlikely, well, God himself is even more unlikely and therefore almost certainly doesn't exist. That's the argument from improbability. Now, you can say a lot more about it. Read his book. Don't take my kind of 10-second version of it for granted. But that's the argument he's making. I have one particular problem with it. I just don't think that, once again, it applies to the kind of God that Jews, Christians, Muslims in particular believe in. It seems to only make sense to me if God is actually part of the creation. Then he might need to be more complex than it. But no Jew, no Christian, no Muslim I know thinks God is part of the creation. God is outside the creation. He's not in time and space. He made them. God is an eternal being. That's what we teach. So the argument just doesn't apply to us. I feel like it might apply to pantheistic belief, where you believe God is part of nature. Maybe then Dawkins is onto something. But we Christians, we've always thought that God is beyond the creation that he creates. He doesn't need it. He creates it out of love. So that's Dawkins' argument for atheism. We've got to do this hard thinking, some of us have at least. We've got to come up with kind of answers and responses and understandings of these very serious inquiries that people are making to try and prove their own worldview. Well, that's philosophical atheism. The second is sociological atheism. These guys are teaching that mature people become atheists. That in fact mature societies become more atheistic. Do people grow out of their theism like they grow out of their belief in the tooth fairy? That's what Dawkins says. He said, if you, as an adult, still believe in an invisible, powerful, loving God, you just haven't got rid of the tooth fairy belief. You've got to go a step further, guys, he says. Get rid of that. Do mature people become atheists? Well, I can certainly give counterexample case studies. The head of the Human Genome Project in America, Francis Collins, is an evangelical Christian. In fact, when Bill Clinton got up and announced that we've now worked out how God did it, which is the way he talked about discovering the human genome, part of the reason he said it that way was because Francis Collins was his advisor. Collins became a Christian at university in his mid to late 20s as a postgrad student. He grew into theism as a scientist, as he understood the world better. Probably the most famous mature convert is C.S. Lewis, who wrestled and wrestled and wrestled into his middle life with the questions of religion, who went from loving myth to believing there was a true myth called Jesus, the Gospel of Jesus. He became a Christian in the middle of his life and went on to be one of the most famous Christian thinkers and public figures of the 20th century. It's just too simplistic to say people grow out of their atheism. In fact, it's insulting to suggest that anyone who remains a theist into their midlife just isn't thinking hard enough. There are too many counterexamples in this room for that to be taken seriously. What about societies? Do societies grow out of religion? And this is interesting because I reckon we've got to take the data seriously on this sort of stuff. We've got to look at the figures and not just go, oh, that's not true. And when you look at the figures on this, they're complex figures, they're hard to interpret, but there is a kind of trend. There's a trend in mature societies where mature is defined as politically stable, high poverty line, increasing education. There is a tendency for those societies to have lower beliefs in the existence of God. The data can be found in the Cambridge Companion to Atheism, in a very large study that was done of surveys around the world. It's got lots of methodological problems, but you know, there's some data there that we ought to examine. Say, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Societies, as they get wealthier, healthier, stabler, more prosperous, belief in God seems to drop. Why could that be so? Well, it could be that humans just decide, actually, I can look after myself. My health's good, got a lot of money, everything's fine. Might just forget about that God stuff. That to me seems a more reasonable interpretation of what goes on in the human heart as your situation changes. It doesn't say anything about whether or not God exists. And in fact, it only takes an event like a death in the family or an awful accident or maybe a terrorist attack on the Twin Towers for us to remember we're not in control. Our money's not going to save us. Our health can't be taken for granted. In fact, we better look at the God question before it's too late. So again, it's just too simplistic to say that societies grow out of theism. They might stop believing in God, but it says nothing about whether or not God is there. It doesn't answer the question at all. Well, our third variety is Darwinian atheism. Darwinian atheism. Now, here I want to tread carefully because my background's in literature, philosophy, thinking about those kinds of things. I'm not a scientist, so don't ask me any questions about creationism, ID, all that sort of stuff. I can just say, sorry, I'm not a scientist. Not my thing to answer. I don't want to say too much about Dawkins, who is a professor in the sciences, and his views on Darwinian evolution. I'll just tell you a bit about what he says. He believes that gradual evolution will eventually explain everything we need to know about human existence. That gradual evolution is so supported as a theory that we would do well to believe it, and it's going to explain everything to us. My philosophical response to that is I find it really difficult to believe that he thinks that science, the study of the how, is ever going to give us all the answers to the why. Science does a great job of describing to us what's going on in the world, what has gone on in the world. Wonderful job. I hope no one here feels anti-science. It does a wonderful job of describing the world to us. It makes mistakes, but it also works out. It makes mistakes, corrects. Science actually progresses. It's a wonderful tool of human understanding. But it doesn't answer any of the basic questions that human beings have. Any of the kids' questions. Dad, why am I here? What's life about? Do you love me? It gives us nothing in the realm of meaning that we really want. It just describes really well what is. I can't believe that we human beings will ever be happy just to describe what is. Isn't that just like being a rock? We're so much richer. We want so many more answers. We want to know about relationships. We want to understand our partners. We want to understand our friends. We want to celebrate things like music and art. And science just gives us none of that. So it's a great theory, in my view as a literary scholar. It's a great theory, evolution. It's a well-attested theory in many ways. I know there's dispute as to how well-attested it is. But it's just not going to answer the questions we've got. It's a crazy thing to hang your hat on as a worldview. I'm an evolutionist. So what? The final area I want to look at, the final variety of atheism, is ethical atheism. This one to me is the most interesting, actually. It's the view that actually atheists and atheism is more moral than religious behaviour or religious thinking. That we'd be better off as atheists. That's the big new teaching of this movement. That we'd be better off if we all jettisoned the God stuff and got on with just living well together with no reference to it at all. I can see where this comes from. It comes out of all that thinking that religion actually has brought awful suffering into the world. That religious people claim to be the good people, and yet look at these priests abusing children in churches. They claim to be the good people, but look at all these ministers who've fallen in adultery and homosexuality and whatever. They claim to be the good people, but look at their middle-class Western comfort. They don't care about the poor. Look at them. I can see where it comes from. I can see where the ethical atheist drive comes from. But I think what is not being acknowledged here is that the things the atheists want are very often the things that Christianity, Judeo-Christianity, has given the world. If you read The God Delusion, you see there's a point in it where Richard Dawkins talks about the kind of ethics he thinks that all civilized nations will develop. A lot of it you could lift from the Ten Commandments, so to speak. A lot of it you can hear echoing the words of Jesus. There are other bits added in, such as liberties about sexual behaviour, as long as you're not hurting anyone else, whatever that means, and treating all species as equal wherever possible. Dawkins thinks this is a basic civilised view, that one. I really wonder how many people are with him on that. I really wonder how many of the poor on the streets of India walking around cows are with him on that. But that's part of his idea of the civilized society of the future. But a lot of it has gleaned from and is parasitic on the things that the Jewish religion and Jesus' interpretation of the Jewish religion gave to the world. Things like loving your neighbour. Love your neighbour is a Jewish teaching. It's to love not only those who are of your clan, but anyone who's near you, anyone who walks along the road near you and is in need. That's your neighbour. The person, the stranger who comes into your midst. Well, Jesus picked up that teaching and he radicalized it. He said, actually, your neighbour is even your enemy. You're meant to love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you, says Jesus. And even that kind of Samaritan over there who you'd never touch, well, he's going to be loving the neighbour better than you Jews. You know, it's radical in Jesus' mind. It's the love command is radicalized by Jesus to be far beyond what we could have come up with ourselves. But ethical atheism wants that. They want a world where love is extended, where neighbourliness is extended as far as possible. They're drawing on Judeo-Christian teaching to get it. The other problem with this desire for living a good life is it's all well and good to say we're going to be ethical atheists, we're going to live a good life, but how are you going to make it happen? Is it just going to happen because Richard Dawkins has told everyone to live that way? What happens when people aren't obeying the codes of atheism that are put forward? Where's the justice? How do you administer justice? All these questions are incredibly difficult if you don't have a God at the end as the good judge. In fact, you have to say there really is no justice that will be done if you take God out of the picture. There might be elements of justice here and there in the world that people administer themselves, but give up any hope of justice being done because you need God for that. The atheists seem to assume that they'll be able to bring about a utopian world, and I'm not exaggerating here. Read the end of the God delusion. Dawkins ends on a very utopian note that we're on the edge of a new society, rid of religion, where everyone's better off. But it's one thing to say that. It's another to know how to get it. And the theologian Oliver O'Donovan writes, all four aspects of liberal society, freedom, mercy, natural right, and openness to free speech, have consistently proved more difficult to realise in effect than to acknowledge in principle. It's all well and good to say what you want, but how to get there without a God? Well, there are four varieties of atheism. They're fascinating. I'm really intrigued by this atheist movement and how confident it is that it's going to give us a better world. What can we do then as Christians in response to this? Firstly, we can read the books. We can actually get engaged with the issues. And if it does interest you, I'd urge you to do that. There's nothing worse than Christian people who kind of think they know about the topic but have never kind of dipped in and looked at what's really said. That puts off your friends immediately. If your friend's reading the God delusion, dip in. If you're worried about your own faith, pray as you do so. Do that anyway. We've got to know what's going on here if we're going to be engaged in the discussion. I've got six pointers, I think, to make in the way I've been trying to respond to the new atheists and see if these are the sorts of things that help you. Six rapid responses to consider. The first is, there's actually a good thing going on in the new atheism. It's a critique of religion. See, Christians are not necessarily religious people. We don't think you please God by obeying laws. We don't think you please God by depriving yourself of things. We don't think you please God by keeping other people in their place according to a code. We think you please God by surrendering humbly to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. We want to critique religion. We want to critique those awful kind of oppressive regimes that some religions put on people, of things you can't eat, days you can't do this, people you can't talk to, clothes you've got to wear. It doesn't get you to God. All that stuff doesn't get you to God. We want to be with the atheists saying that's not the way. We want to preach up the gospel as the answer to that. Jesus has got you to God because you couldn't get there yourself. So we're on board with that element of the atheist agenda, and we can at least talk about that with our friends. That, yeah, we don't see ourselves as first and foremost religious people. We see ourselves as gospel people. Secondly, the thing that these books have done is really highlight terrible areas of Christian sinfulness. Awful things done in the Inquisition, terrible stories of child sexual abuse in particular. That's really the issue of our times that has given Christianity a bad name, and rightly so. Rightly so. We ought to stand and say sorry as representatives of the Christian church for these things. They're terrible. They're terrible abuses of the name of Christ. We want to apologise for any connection we have with these abuses of Christianity. And we want to look in our own hearts and see what we need to apologise for our attitudes to other people, for the way we've mistreated them. There's great power in apology. Come on, blokes, you know this in your marriages. There's great power in apology. If you can say sorry, it's incredibly useful to building relationships. There's a lot to be sorry about if you identify yourself with the Christian church. And we ought to condemn that Christian sinfulness, just as the atheists do. Say, yep, we need forgiveness. On our own, we're scum. Thirdly, as I've already mentioned, we ought not to be tricked into thinking that atheists have come up with a better way to live on their own. They've actually built it on the basis of Judeo-Christianity. Now, you might think that's just evolved over time, but it's incredibly difficult to demonstrate that. It's much easier to demonstrate that it's come through the specific teachings of the Jewish and Christian religions that we have the kind of Western society that we have. In fact, even the secular philosophers are recognising this now and saying, if you took Christianity out of the story of the rise of Europe, you wouldn't get the kind of Western world you like living in. It's given you things like telling the truth. It's given you things like caring for your family. It's given you things like hospitals for the poor. It's given you education. How many of the world's universities began as religious institutions and have over hundreds of years lost it? Christianity in particular was there at the beginning, giving the West its roots. So to think that atheists have somehow come up with a better world without that, well, they're just not paying credit where credit is due. It's worth pointing out. Fourthly, in these books, atheists are still avoiding the best arguments about God and leaning on the worst. The example in Michel Onfray's book is of how he dumps on the New Testament and says, tell me if John told you about this, that Jews were not crucified in the first century. Did that come up? No, it's okay. You've got to go to our website and watch his video on that one. Michel Onfray suggests Jews really weren't crucified around that time, so the Gospels must be fake. It's just not true. Any ancient historian, Christian, Calathumpian, atheist, whatever, who looks at the data knows Jews were crucified. They're among the most crucified people of the times. So you can't let these guys get away with sprouting forth this rubbish. They're using terrible arguments to support what seem to be prejudices. Furthermore, they really aren't taking seriously and digging into the good Christian thinking on these topics. It's taken a very long time for Richard Dawkins to come around to even debating Christians. And when he's doing so, he's not faring so well. He doesn't think theology is worth reading. Well, at least we're giving him the respect of reading his material. Atheists will use the worst arguments and they'll avoid the best. Fifthly, as I've said, we can't accept this view that people just grow out of theism. It's just not true. There are too many counterexamples. Too many of us in this room have grown into belief in God by hearing about his son Jesus. It's just too simplistic a thesis to say that the world is growing out of religion and we're going to move on to something better. It's a sweeping idea that lots of people like the feel of, but it doesn't match with the actual lives that people are leading. and two at once. The atheist remains the rarity. Don't be tricked into thinking that because this movement is out there, there are heaps and heaps of atheists everywhere. You'll find pockets of atheists in certain places. But most people, in most places, at most times in history, have believed there is a God. It's the basic human understanding. It's the basic thing that we observe as we come into the world and become aware. That's why the Bible says that men are without excuse. Because most people in most places at most times have believed there is a God. The atheist is the rarity. And the last one, I've said a lot of critical things today, but I'm actually really pleased that these books are out there. I'm really pleased that you go into a bookshop and on the shelves marked religion, half of them are taken up by books on atheism. Because it's put religion on the agenda again, like the Da Vinci Code did. It's put religion on the agenda. It gives you something to talk about. It gives you a way into the discussion. It gets you into the really heavy, meaty stuff with the people you want to introduce to Jesus. It's given us pathways of bringing men towards Christ. I'd urge you to take up the possibilities that are here. Find some aspect of it you're interested in. Research it a bit. Do a bit of reading. Talk to some friends. Look at our website. Do whatever you need to bone yourself up on the topic so you can engage your friends with this opportunity. My last point is, there's a way we need to do this. You see, we need to respond to the new atheists, not in kind, but kindly. Not in kind, but kindly. I've been pretty critical in what I've said today. I've tried not to pull my punches, but I hope I've been gracious to the atheist agenda. I've listened. I've heard what they have to say. I've acknowledged where they're right. Because they're not doing that to us. And if we respond in the same way, we betray the Lord we serve. We've got to model what Christianity is all about in the way we engage with these very emotional, very trying, very frustrating topics. The last point I have for you then is from the scriptures. It's from the book of James, and this verse means a lot to me as I go about my work in corporations or in the pub or whatever, talking to people. I often think of this verse from James. But who is the wise and understanding among you? Who's the one who thinks they know how to talk? The one who thinks they understand God? Who thinks they can explain things to people? Who's, you know, on the ball about this? Well, it's not the one with the doctorate. It's not the one who's read all the books. By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. It's actually what you do and how you do it that convinces people that Jesus is worth following. It's the words that come out of your mouth. It's the tone of them. It's the way you care for people. It's whether you remember that they were talking to you about atheism last week. It's your conduct that people notice. It's you in the flesh working out your life as a Christian. Your words and your deeds together that people notice and interests them about why you're that way. And real wisdom has a kind of meekness. Because you know you're serving the great God and his agenda, not your own intellectual empire or your own progress or winning points. True wisdom develops meekness because you're so aware of the greatness of God and what an honor it is to be serving him. Well, let me finish there. Can I take a few questions, George? You got time for that?
Yep.
You want to...
Yeah, okay. Let me just say that it is afternoon tea time, but all the other people can get afternoon tea first, okay? And we can follow them. No, that's okay, because I think we will take a few minutes to take some questions. If you would speak up loudly, and then Greg can repeat the question so everyone can hear it, and it'll go on the tape and so on. What are we saying over here? Oh, terrific. Okay, first question over there.
I've not read any of the atheists, but I noticed that we concentrate on Christians. Have they been going to stick up the Muslims as well as us?
I'll just remind you of my last point. If I can make a kind answer to that, rather than in kind, they do talk about other religions as well. They do. Although I think it's fair to say that Christianity is actually in the middle of the target. So certainly Islam comes up for great scrutiny. And depending on which writer you're reading, some of them like Eastern religions and some of them don't. Some of them think, well, that's okay, that's kind of philosophy and myth. But others think that's just as bad and just as oppressive, we should get rid of that as well. None of these fairy stories for us. So, yes, it's a general attack on religion. But Christianity is right in the middle of the target. And it's hard to know why. Because Christianity, when you read the Gospels, teaches peace, love, forgiveness, mercy, God's kindness, things that are really hard to attack. But Christian behaviour in history, that's what they attack. When people have moved away from the real Christian way of doing things, well, that's when they open up the weaponry. And we kind of deserve it, don't we? Yeah. But Christianity itself, for some reason, is right in the middle. I think Dawkins has said it's the thing he's going to critique the most because it's the thing he knows the most. But they do attack all religion. Yeah.
There's another question over here.
Yeah. Oh, front row? Front row.
Okay, front row first, then the gentleman down on the right there.
Yeah. I read McGrath's book on critique on Dawkins. It seems McGrath seems to be saying that people like Dawkins really misrepresent things quite regularly in the way they operate. Do you think that's a fair view of how they operate in the new atheists?
So the question is, do the atheists misrepresent things? I think there's often a distortion of scholarship for the thesis at hand. So there'll be a distortion, or particularly in areas that are not their own area of expertise. So when Dawkins moves out of the sciences and into philosophy, religion, history, even literature, he makes all sorts of faux pas, some little, some big. And those who have knowledge in those areas go, hang on, this guy, he's not for real. He's not taking seriously my discipline, he's taking his seriously, but he's giving me no respect. So there is a fair critique there, I think, of these writers. Yep.
I'm not sure if it's Dawkins, but I've heard one of these writers refer to the Christian education of children as being, I think, the form of child abuse. How popular or how far much have you come across that view? And what would you say should be our response to that?
Yeah. The question is, how significant is the claim that the main problem with religion is that it abuses children? It's a big part of the argument. In fact, Dawkins has gone so far as to say it's the reason he's so angry. It's the way children are treated. Now, who knows why that is in his own psychology or background or whatever. We all, you know, come from where we are to our views. But I think the view that people grow up as a Muslim child or a Christian child or whatever, that's the thing he finds really offensive. I've got some sympathies with this. I think, you know, we as parents have to be careful that we are educating our children in what we think is right, but in a way that doesn't shut them down as they develop into adults who are thinking for themselves, or adolescents who are thinking for themselves. But where I think he overstates it is that lots of kids think for themselves on the way through. Sure, there's a kind of kid who will always be following the trail, but heaps of kids are thinking for themselves from a very early age, and I know a few of them quite closely. And Dawkins himself was one of these children. So in his early, I think, I may get this wrong, I think he was about 10 or something when he was given Darwin's Origins of Species and started to think about the world differently to his parents. So, you know, there are children who are put into boxes and not allowed to think for themselves, but we got to stop that. We got to teach children what we think is the truth in a way that allows them to disagree or allows them to explore other possibilities. We do have to respect them as children, but we also have to do our job as parents communicating what we think is true. So that's a great question, and it's a big part of the conversation.